Case number 16-7142, Shamin Kaplan, individually and naturally guardian, and guardian of plaintiffs MK1, ALK, MK2, CK, and EK et al. For the appellant, and versus the Central Bank of Islamic Republic of Iran, also known as Bank Markazi Jamhuri, Islami Iran et al. Mr. Katz for the appellant, Mr. Frey for the appellee.
Good morning.
Please, the court, Mayor Katz on behalf of the plaintiffs' appellants. In 2006, over a period of about 34 days, Hezbollah launched thousands of rockets into civilian areas in Israel with the sole intent of terrorizing the civilian population, killing, maiming, injuring, instilling fear in the civilian population. They packed in those rockets thousands of steel ball bearings, 4 millimeters, 6 millimeters, depending on the rocket, the sole purpose of which was to hurt people. Those steel ball bearings don't do anything to harden military objects, structures and tanks and whatnot. They don't have any military objective at all. The purpose of the bearings, again, was to hurt people. The plaintiffs are those victims and their families seeking relief under the Anti-Terrorism Act. The Anti-Terrorism Act, of course, has an exception, the act of war exception, that animates much of this litigation. The district court decided that these attacks, these clear, grotesque acts of terrorism, were nonetheless acts of war because they coincided with a war, what the district court referred to as a war happening elsewhere, and resolved the case on that basis despite not reaching personal jurisdiction. As the Supreme Court has made clear, and as this court has made clear many times, you can't do that. You first have to establish, you with the district court, has to first establish your right to right to declare law, your right to adjudicate, your right to jurisdiction, before actually adjudicating, before declaring law. By skipping over personal jurisdiction, the district court's actions were ultra vires and void on that ground. There's a lot of interesting things to talk about in this case. In this
appeal. Do you think you have personal jurisdiction?
Your Honor, but I think that the record is badly incomplete below, in large part because we've learned a lot since we put our record forth, I think, in 2010 on this issue. It's been quite a long time. And the case law has changed dramatically. But I think under existing law...
Not in a helpful way for you.
Well, yes and no. I mean, some of the cases have been helpful, some of the cases have been harmful. And certainly, as a matter of general jurisdiction, I think we can see that that's over. But I think that there are very significant avenues now that maybe didn't exist quite so clearly to argue that Hezbollah and the banks, or the appellees here, deliberate targeting of the United States. Let me clarify. The banks did not do it directly. It was aiding and abetting. But they knew what was going on, we posit. And we think they have evidence to support that. They were directly targeting the United States, and that fact is enough to create personal jurisdiction. This would be our primary point on remand. But again, I do think that remand is necessary here because the record is so incomplete.
Wait, I mean, you tried.
I'm sorry?
What is your standing to raise this?
Standing to raise personal jurisdiction?
Yeah.
Well, we didn't raise it in this appeal. In the Hezbollah appeal, it's slightly more complicated, but the banks raised it below. It was litigated below, but the banks raised it. The district court didn't reach it.
But I think the question is, isn't there something a little bit odd about your raising an argument now as to which you think you should win?
No, if you look ahead to what we're anticipating is going to happen. We hope to get a judgment against the banks that we hope to then enforce. Other victims of terrorism, a little background on how this works, if Your Honor's not aware. The Seventh Circuit has some dicta on this. It's very interesting. They call it a cruel race between victims of terrorism. Victims of terrorism get judgments that are very often not easily enforceable because there's no assets. They have to compete against each other to gain whatever assets are available, usually not enough. Not enough to go around, certainly. And these victims of terrorism have to fight against each other in these enforcement actions. It's extremely likely that another set of victims is going to try to get money that we've attempted to seize, saying our judgment's not enforceable because personal jurisdiction was not established, and therefore the district court's decision was ultra vires and void.
But at that point, that's the enforcement proceeding, I guess, right?
Correct.
At that point, wouldn't personal jurisdiction be litigated anew? It's not as if at that point we know that there's a problem with the judgment because personal jurisdiction wasn't established. The question would be whether there was personal jurisdiction in the first suit. No? Is that not how it works?
It's, I suppose it could be raised, but I don't think so. I mean, we, this future court, would have to establish that the district judge below properly entered judgment.
Right.
And if not, then the judgment is void. Determining after the fact there's another court sitting and reviewing this in some other circuit.
No, but suppose, for example, the second proceeding happens and the defendants, they can waive personal jurisdiction, right?
Correct.
So suppose in the second proceeding they just waive personal jurisdiction, any objection on personal jurisdiction grounds. Can that not happen?
I don't believe so. They can't waive it retroactively. At that point, they would be waiving it vis-a-vis the enforcement proceeding,
right,
which they might not even be party to necessarily. I mean, it's their assets, but money might be held by a bank, which is what typically happens. And then the litigation is against the bank. But even if they were party, they could waive it as to the enforcement proceeding. I don't know if they can waive it retroactively as to this proceeding.
And they haven't waived it as to this proceeding.
And they haven't, correct. I mean, that's the more important point.
So what would happen on remand? So is there any reason to think that on remand, suppose that it did go back for personal jurisdiction, is there any reason to think that even if you prevailed on personal jurisdiction, that anything differently is going to happen with respect to the active war exception?
Well, I don't know. We certainly hope so, but I think that two things. First of all,
would you have an argument that the district court, that something, in other words, is there something in personal jurisdiction that's germane to the question of active war, or are we just going through an exercise, which I'm not saying we shouldn't go through the exercise, but are we just going through the exercise to get to the inevitable point that we're going to just face the same issue again?
Two points. The Supreme Court, I think this was Justice Ginsburg, I forget which case, determining jurisdiction is not a legal nicety. It's an obligation. And it has to do with the power of courts. You can't just skip it. And even though it might result in redundancy, those are the rules. And the Supreme Court's been very, very clear about that. Second, I'm not saying this is what's going to happen. This is all hypothesis. It has not been discussed. I'm being very clear. It has not been discussed internally among the attorneys. There are cases right now in New York involving these same defendants being litigated regarding personal jurisdiction. It's possible, and this is my hypothesis, I'm speaking individually, that the case might be transferred there. We might try to transfer the case to New York. We might oppose it. I don't know. But there is certainly a possibility that this case could wind up in New York, in which case the act of war decision will be determined by a New York court.
What's the status of personal jurisdiction in the New York courts?
There's a motion for jurisdictional discovery currently pending. I'm not personally directly involved in the litigation, but that's from 30,000 feet, that's what I know.
Mm-hmm. But you're assuming that this is jurisdictional in the Steel Co. sense. We have case law to the contrary.
Which case, Your Honor?
Okay. I'll pull it for you in a minute. That is not the way the D.C. Circuit has been reading it, to put personal jurisdiction in the category of Article III jurisdiction.
I think
that would force us to follow the Steel Co. notion that you must decide jurisdictional questions first. I'll give it to you in a minute. I mean, apart from the standing, I mean, it really does sound like a bootstrapping request to get us back again to try again, and I'm not understanding how you have the standing to make the claim. But quite apart from that, the law in this circuit, there's a split in the circuits, but the law in this circuit doesn't tend to favor you.
Your Honor, respectfully, I think the Flores case is right on point and says exactly what we needed to say. I mean, if Your Honor has another case, it's more recent. Flores was decided in 2016, I think.
No, but that, I think it's a little, I'm not saying you necessarily lose on that, but I think it's a little bit different to say that you can do personal jurisdiction as a threshold matter,
right,
at the outset.
That's not the question.
As to say that you have to do personal jurisdiction in a steel company sense. They're not
we
unrelated.
We have said the contrary. But of course you can. But that's not the question. In that case that you're referring to is not apt. I'm talking about whether you must is the Steel Co. question. To the extent that we've opined on it, you said the opposite.
Your Honor, respectfully, I wish to know which case you're referring to.
Shalabi.
Yes, Shalabi. Let me just refresh my memory here.
Shalabi v. Gates and Shalabi v. Hashim.
Can't find it, no. I actually wrote some notes on that case as I was going through this.
I guess you've got Sinochem.
I'm sorry?
Which I guess you've got Sinochem, the language from the Supreme Court's decision.
Correct. I think Sinochem is extremely helpful. I don't know, you know. That's
a good one for you. And 4S is, I think, probably helpful for you, too. I mean, I'm not sure I agree with that, but I am sure that's not relevant. that I don't agree with it, because it looks like the Supreme Court has lumped personal jurisdiction in.
I think the case law is fairly clear.
No, it's not fairly clear. I mean, the sense of your argument is there may be some law subsequent to the decisions to which I'm pointing, including Lexmark, which should cause us to shift our position. But the law in the circuit now is not clearly in your favor, quite the contrary. Now, you may have notes you need to look at.
Which I can't find, unfortunately.
Yeah, right. Those cases do not support your position in saying that personal jurisdiction is among the jurisdictional requirements that must be decided under Steel Co. I understand there have been later developments, and there's a way to play that out, and the panel will have to think about whether they're prepared to do that. Zonicrim, and there's language in other cases, including Lexmark, but I'm not sure.
And the Supreme Court's more recent cases than the ones you're saying.
There's a way to try, and we would be changing the law of the circuit, though.
I unfortunately, it's difficult for me to respond with the time I have right here, but.
Can I ask you this question?
Sure.
So there's an alien tort statute claim in this case also. So you don't think that your argument as to act of war also applies to the alien tort statute? In other words, that because the district court went ahead and addressed the merits without reaching personal jurisdiction, that was a problem?
I think that the alien tort statute is this my time, including rebuttal time? I'm sorry.
We'll give you some rebuttal time. Don't worry about that.
The alien tort statute is a jurisdictional provision. So I think that works a little bit differently, because when you're deciding the merits of the alien tort statute, you are necessarily deciding jurisdiction.
But does that mean, so is there any such thing as a 12b6 motion in an alien tort statute case?
That's a great question. They're filed all the time. I'm not sure that that's
correct. But it sounds like, based on your argument, and maybe the other side sounds like they agree with you on this, that there's no such thing as a 12b6 argument, that everything is actually a 12b1 argument, necessarily, because it's an alien tort statute.
Again, it's litigated all the time like that.
I know it's litigated all the time like that, but is it right to litigate it like that?
I'm not sure. I don't think so, but I don't know.
Well, suppose you had a situation in which, for example, the defendant, you bring a suit, and the defendant doesn't even make an argument as to extraterritoriality, and then it goes up on appeal. It sounds to me like you'd acquiesce in the notion that there's been no waiver, there's been no forfeiture, because you can't waiver forfeit subject matter jurisdiction, and you as the plaintiff would be in the position of having to litigate the question of extraterritoriality, even though by hypothesis the defendant never raised it.
I mean, yes, with the caveat that I'm on the spot, and I might think that
that's
the
just
tomorrow,
one of the weirdnesses of the alien tort statute.
It's a very, very unusual statute, and it makes it very difficult.
Well, if you think that's right, I'm not necessarily sure that's right.
Okay.
But it seems like the upshot of your view would be that.
I think so. I mean, yeah. I just can't hear right now. That sounds correct. As to extraterritoriality, it's the same argument that I made with regard to personal jurisdiction. The record is just inadequate, just based on, given all that we know now, things that have come out now that weren't known before, that are available to the court, publicly available things that are filed on dockets elsewhere, but were not part of the record, I don't know that this court can reach the issue just yet. We've put in our briefs significant evidence that there's a great body of new evidence out there that just wasn't considered by the district court before. So I think that there too, remand would be the proper approach to allow the district court to consider it in the first instance.
But was there any effort to put that evidence into the record after Kiobel came down?
After Kiobel, no. Please understand, though, that the motion was filed 2 years before Kiobel was decided. It was sitting dormant. We didn't know. We were very confused. I mean, the case kind of flew off the map. Mm-hmm. Kiobel came down. I forget if it was 2 months or 4 months, but one or the other, and the decision came down. It caught us by surprise. Our opponents didn't put Kiobel in a letter noting subsequent authority. I mean, the case didn't exist as far as we knew. It was in a very strange state of limbo.
Kiobel didn't exist?
No. Our case. I was not, again, personally involved. I think it was assigned to Chief Judge Roberts before his unfortunate situation. So we had no idea what was going on. It would have put us in a very strange position to come to the court and say, here's this new authority, all this new evidence, in a case that a motion was pending for 2 years. I want to come back to one point that just got
Can you tell me how you have time? Is your appeal timely under Cambridge?
Under Cambridge. 100%, Your Honor, for many reasons, and in 30 seconds I can't. But
take the time you need. We'll give you extra time. Don't worry.
I appreciate that. I do want to come back to something Judge Kavanaugh asked.
The time limits question is important. There's nothing else to talk about.
Absolutely.
You're not here on time, and I'm struggling with that. And there's a split. I'm going to just tell you the question to answer. There's a split in the circuits, 5th and 9th, I think it's 9th. Not the Ninth Circuit position. The other one seems a more fitting resolution of the issue, and if I followed that, you would not be timely. Your appeal would not be timely.
Respectfully, I disagree.
I'm sure you do. I'm asking you what's your answer.
Yes. Even under the Fifth Circuit standard, which I would argue doesn't apply, but let's just hypothetically. Under the Fifth Circuit standard, nevertheless, I think that we would still survive. Because even though the Fifth Circuit held, if I remember correctly, that the clear express intent for future proceedings is not relevant, nevertheless, the Rand was served before the time to appeal had run. The time to appeal, I think, would have been February 17, 2014, and they were served on the 16th. We made it by one day, but we made it. Moreover, the procedural requirements for service were done many months before. It's a long process to serve a foreign state that doesn't have diplomatic relations. We completed our obligations, I think, by October of the prior year, way before the order was entered under Rule 58. So I believe even under the Fifth Circuit standard, we win. I don't think the Fifth Circuit standard is law of the circuit. The Cambridge expressly reserved the question.
Yeah, Cambridge merely reserved, but we may be looking at wrong dates. I don't see how you make it in time with the service. That's perplexing to me. I'll have to go back and look at the dates again.
I believe it's in our reply brief. I'll try to flip through. Unless you want to ask further questions on this particular issue.
Why don't you handle that?
Cambridge asks whether or not the parties were served at the time of the order dismissing the claims, not at the time of the appeal, when the appeal ran out. You're answering the wrong question. If you're going to follow Cambridge, it asks whether the other parties were served at the time of the order dismissing the claims against the served defendants. That's the test.
Your Honor, you're correct.
Okay, so you don't meet that. You said they were served in time. That not under Cambridge, they were not.
Under Rule 54, the fact that they were served in time makes them parties. And
we've got to follow the law of the circuit. If I'm following Cambridge, I've got to follow that test. It is not at odds with the federal rules, and you don't meet the test. So I'm trying to figure out how the appeal is timely. I can't get to any of the rest if you don't have a timely appeal. Forgetting my concerns about the personal jurisdiction.
Agreed. Cambridge was dealing with a very, very different factual scenario. And therefore, it didn't address this particular issue. Cambridge was talking
about... Which issue didn't it address?
The fact that that this party was served before... The party was never served in Cambridge. In our case, the party was served before the time to appeal would have run. I'm saying that makes it very
difficult. The problem is they set a test that addresses that question.
I don't believe it addresses that question for the simple reason that it would have made it in opposite with or contrary to Rule 54. Rule 54 requires that there not be more than one party. And what Cambridge says is that you look at the served parties. Those are the relevant parties for the purposes of Rule 54. What I'm saying is that you have to look at that period throughout the entire time that the appeal is available. Cambridge doesn't talk about that, I agree. But it's necessarily true, because at that point there are now two parties. And we can't proceed with the appeal against one of those two parties at that point. So even if the order had been entered and the time to appeal had started, it couldn't have possibly run on us. Because again, by that time that would have happened, there was now another
party.
It could
if you follow Cambridge. You're saying you don't like the implications of Cambridge, and I'm not sure that's terribly satisfying.
I'm saying that
because the words in Cambridge are clear how you run the clock.
Well, there is language in Cambridge that's clear, but then Cambridge goes on to say more. So I'm not sure how clear it is ultimately. It seems to contradict itself.
I mean, it seems to me you're saying you don't really have an answer and you like to play the footnote out to your advantage, but I don't see how you get around Cambridge. Incidentally, and I'll let you look at it on rebuttal. I'm not going to waste any more of your time. The cases that I'm talking about from this circuit post-Synacrem.
Which case?
Kramer v. Gates and Shabali versus Hashimate.
Okay. Just one other point regarding personal jurisdiction.
And both say Steel Co. applies only to Article III jurisdictional issues.
Okay.
And I'm not saying, I don't know whether that's right or wrong if I were writing on a blank slate, but I know what we've said, and so the question is, did the law of the circuit clear in a way that disposes of what you raised? I know how I would argue it on the other side of it, and I'm not giving you the back of the hand in your argument, but I am saying to you, I am bound by circuit law, and there are a couple of opinions in this circuit that go against you.
And the circuit is bound by the Supreme Court law. Now, you're telling me this post-date Senecam.
I mean, yes.
Judge Kavanaugh, you asked me about personal jurisdiction.
Yeah, you had one additional point you wanted to make.
I have one word.
Yeah.
Leachy. Okay. You asked me about subsequent changes in law. That's my answer.
Okay.
I can explain to you. If there are no further questions.
Okay. We'll hear you on rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Jeremy Fry for Bank Santarat-Iran and Bank Santarat PLC. The district court should be affirmed. He got it right. Judge Lamberth got it right.
Let's start with personal jurisdiction.
Yes, sir.
You agree, I assume, that there is not personal jurisdiction in this case.
We agree that there is not jurisdiction.
You have not waived personal jurisdiction.
We have not, Your Honor.
And nor are you waiving it here.
We are not.
Okay. And what do we do with the 4S case of our court, which seems to suggest, and we have cases that point in different directions, but seems to suggest that we have to address personal jurisdiction, or the lower court does, before hitting the merits?
So there are several reasons why, Your Honors, there is no defect in hypothetical jurisdiction that is presented in this case, even if this court should get so far as hypothetical jurisdiction, because, in fact, this is a final order. So
we'll get to that. I'm sequencing, and I'll just start with personal jurisdiction, but we'll get to that, too.
So there's several reasons why there is no issue with hypothetical jurisdiction. It is not the law of the circuit that there's an issue that was presented here.
When you say that, how do you deal with 4S specifically, which is a 2016 case?
Yes, Your Honor. So we believe that with respect to 4S, that 4S is not controlling. And the reason is
4S was very critical of the district court in that case for not addressing personal jurisdiction before the merits.
So primarily it's because the issue is not an Article III question.
But 4S didn't stop on that.
And also because
you might think 4S is wrong, and I might agree with you, but 4S goes out of its way to be pretty tough on the district court there for not doing personal jurisdiction
so
first.
So we think even on that reading of 4S, that 4S is not a problem because Judge Weinberg in this case specifically denied he was assuming hypothetical jurisdiction in his opinion. He may not have addressed personal jurisdiction as compared to subject matter jurisdiction. But this is unlike any other hypothetical jurisdiction case, I think, that's ever occurred. Because in this case, this opinion of Judge Lamberth says, I am not assuming hypothetical jurisdiction. And there is therefore no basis to assume that the court turned around and did exactly what
the
court was denying.
So you say he implicitly concluded that there was personal jurisdiction?
He implicitly considered the issue of personal jurisdiction for the purposes of his power. That doesn't mean he found personal jurisdiction. That means only that whatever was required was satisfied.
I don't understand that.
Sure. So the court in this opinion said, I am not assuming hypothetical jurisdiction.
Right.
And by that, he then went on to address subject matter jurisdiction. And by doing that, he did not fail to consider the power of the court with respect to the issues that were presented in the case. That's not to say he found whatever he needed to find.
I don't understand what it means to say fail to consider, because that makes it sound like for subject matter jurisdiction, it's okay if you just consider it, but you don't resolve it. That can't be right. You have to actually decide that jurisdiction exists, right? It's not enough to say, there is a jurisdictional question, I'll consider it, but I'm going to do the merits first.
I don't think any of the cases provide any particular standard for the purposes.
Why are you not addressing the Chevalier and Kramer? I mean, maybe there's a conflict in our opinions, but Chevalier says nothing in the Supreme Court's recent cases, and this is after Senate Crown, requires us to depart from treating steel coders relating only to Article III jurisdictional issues.
Yes, sir.
Which is consistent with the other circuits that have gone that way.
And that is correct.
Now, I'm looking at 4S, and 4S, I mean, there's a lot of language in there, but they're not addressing Chevalier at all, or the other case. And it's not a large statement on personal jurisdiction. It focuses a lot on subject matter jurisdiction, which is an Article III issue. So, I mean, maybe we have a split within our own circuit. I don't know. Maybe you can get that out of 4S, but 4S certainly does not vitiate the holding in Chevalier.
I agree.
Well, but how about this with those cases? Do you have a position on this, that if the alternative in those cases was a question of statutory jurisdiction, right? So the choice was between Article III and statutory jurisdiction. As I recall those cases, they stand for the proposition that we don't care about statutory jurisdiction, what we care about Article III, but they didn't specifically involve personal jurisdiction. I'm not saying that they don't resolve the question. They might, actually. But at least it seems to me there's a possible distinction in that they involved the choice between Article III and statutory jurisdiction, whereas this one involves personal jurisdiction, which is somewhere in the middle, arguably. I don't know that that's true, but that's an argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so once again...
Well, I agree, I think, with what Judge Srinivasan just said, but that then leads us to 4S, and that's personal jurisdiction, and that's our court last year saying a district court erred significantly by not first considering personal jurisdiction before going to the merits. Now, again, I'm not sure what I think about that, but I'm sure that's what it says. At least I was sure. I'm reading it right now again. But you don't think there's personal jurisdiction here. So,
correct.
So the bottom line question I have is, why shouldn't we just send it back to the district court for the quick determination, hopefully quick, of lack of personal jurisdiction? Because under the Supreme Court's recent personal jurisdiction cases, which I'm sure you enjoy, it's very difficult to show personal jurisdiction in this case, most likely.
So for any number of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, as we've indicated, we think this is an Article III issue.
Okay.
An Article III issue. Secondly, we think that the issue on which this case was decided, Act of War, is an issue of subject matter jurisdiction. And as a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, it is not, even in the event that personal jurisdiction
right.
is required.
Unlike the Alien Tort Statute, which does speak kind of oddly, as Judge Srinivasan was pointing out, to jurisdiction, this statute does not have that jurisdictional language. And it does seem odd to think that, to me, instinctively, and looking at the body of case law, that Act of War determination would somehow be jurisdictional. So flesh that out for me.
So the reason that we think Act of War is a matter of subject jurisdiction is because of its placement and function in the statutory scheme itself of the ATA. It is presented separately with a cross-reference to Section 233, the cause of action, and which in turn refers to jurisdiction. And the text itself directs that this limitation is in substance directed at the power of the court and not as an issue of merit, because it governs all civil causes of action that arise under Section 233. It is akin to the political question doctrine, as noted by Judge Lamberth in his
opinion. So can I ask you this about this line of argument, which is that 2336 is entitled Other Limitations.
Yes, sir.
So we look at the statute that precedes it, which is the statute that speaks of limitations. And this is the appendage to that, which is Other Limitations. If you look at the statute 2335 that's limitations, the limitation that's at issue there is a statute of limitations, mm-hmm. which everybody agrees is non-jurisdictional.
I think the answer is it depends upon the context in which the issue is being joined and the function.
So do you think that 2335 is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction?
No, I don't. But to analogize.
Okay, so let me just finish this question,
yes,
and then please, I don't mean to cut you off. Mm-hmm. But so my question is this. If 2335, everybody agrees, including you, is non-jurisdictional and it's a statute of limitations, and it also uses the word maintained, it seems to me there's something a little bit odd in saying that the appendage to that provision, which is other limitation, somehow comes back into the can of jurisdiction in that it also uses the word maintained.
So, we believe the court is right to focus on that language. It depends on the context in which the issue arises. And so, for example, if we consider act of war, and in fact, I think your reference to 2335 is in an oblique way kind of helpful to our position on this issue, and that is it would be as if act of war was a statute of limitations with a zero time period. And that's part of the reason in which we can observe the operation of 2336 joined as it is with 2337, which is clearly jurisdictional, and also uses the language of maintained. So I think it depends upon the context and the structure and the operation of the specific provision in the statutory scheme. I don't think, the term limitation, as we've seen from the SLUSA case, S-L-U-S-A, that we've referred to, in any way undermines it, supports
so
that.
So I don't think limitation is necessarily dispositive, because I think it could, at least there's good arguments that it could be construed both as jurisdictional and non-jurisdictional. But where you have other limitations following a limitation that is non-jurisdictional, that seems to be a context that would suggest that this one, too, is non-jurisdictional.
And I'm not sure whether Your Honor is referring to the other limitations in 2336 or 2335, but in 2336, the other limitations were only added after the statute was originally enacted as a standalone provision with no other provisions in 2336 than the provision with respect to act of war. So
the upshot of saying it's jurisdictional,
yes,
would
sir,
be that even if act of war was not raised, the court would have to consider it.
Correct.
That's strange. Why would that why would that scheme be set up by Congress?
So at the end of the day, Your Honor, this is about whether or not these kinds of actions, tort claims arising, for example, from battlefield torts, whether they are going to be heard by the court in the first instance. And we think there's wisdom in the provisions with respect to act of war in Section 2336, separately presented as it is,
right,
in the statutory scheme, to pretermit the allowance of causes of action to continue on.
I hear you, but if a party doesn't raise active war or affirmatively waives it by calling it jurisdictional, the court still needs to consider it independently. And seems odd, but I take your point on the broader concept. The second point I wanted to raise is the Supreme Court's told us repeatedly over the last 10, 15 years that in situations where it's ambiguous, don't call something jurisdictional. I'm shorthanding that, but that's the basic message from the Supreme Court. And why doesn't this fall within that general principle?
And there are adequate indications in the statute to rebut exactly that point. And these are the issues that we've both presented in our briefs and have presented here. Section 2337, clearly jurisdictional, and yet it operates in the same way. Its function within the statute, it is not analogous to a statute of limitations. And it does bear remarkable resemblance, for example, to the provision in SLUSA. We think the language of to maintain, unless the context otherwise shows, is the language of subject matter jurisdiction.
Can you get the time limits at some point on the appeal?
Yes, go to that.
I'm happy to address that, as Your Honor might imagine, because the reason that we're never going to reach these arguments about Article 3 and 4S, the issues associated with active war, which are quite important in this case, are never reached because the plaintiffs waived their appeal. And to the extent this separate order issue is banging around in the 150 days or 180 days from the date, Cambridge is clear that the issue is not whether or not another party is added during that period of time. It is measured from the time at which the order is entered. And if it's 30 days, they're out of time. If it's 150 days, they're out of time. If it's 180 days, they're out of time, because they did not file in that period of time. So the answer about the separate order question and the applicability of the 180-day or 150-day period is really is really not important.
What about the fact that the district court order arguably anticipated additional proceedings, and there is language about that concern in Cambridge? How do we deal with that here? Because it does seem like the district court, if we took your position, I could see someone thinking this was not fair given how the district court's order was phrased.
Well, of course, some of those provisions that are contained in the order, you know, specifically basically notice the plaintiffs that the order is final because there are no other unserved parties. So in that respect, the other provisions of the order are not concerning. To the extent it constitutes a sort of contingency, the Atias case, which was cited as supplemental authority by the plaintiffs, is actually a nice counterpoint for that. Atias involved a court order in which there was a finding without prejudice, or I'm sorry, with prejudice, but there was no there was also a provision with respect to the potential filing of additional complaints. In that case, they are addressing a situation in which the parties are there is a party before the court. In Cambridge, and for purposes of Rule 54B, there are no parties.
Is there anything a district court can do in this situation then where a party hasn't been properly served to keep the case going? Or are you saying that any time the district court enters a judgment as to the parties that have been served, if there's any parties that haven't been served, and everybody assumes that it's just a technicality, it's easy to serve this party, they actually are right there to it's not a situation where the party's never going to be served, it's a situation which everybody assumes they're going to be served. It's just some technicality. That the district court, that it doesn't matter that the judgment is final, the clock starts ticking right away.
The judgment is final and the clock starts ticking.
And that means piecemeal appeals. Though.
Right.
And, of course, that can be managed by the court. It can be managed potentially by the district court, but that's what
Well, isn't that what the district court here did, try to manage it by that last couple paragraphs in the opinion to say there are remaining claims, kind of gives the indications that service needs to be had on those remaining defendants, and seems to contemplate that that could happen. And
no.
Then it did arguably happen.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. No,
go
because
ahead.
Because Cambridge indicates that this issue, unlike the issue of contingency arising, for example, in the Atias case, is an issue of jurisdiction. So the answer is...
Well, suppose Cambridge leaves that open. I think the footnote seems to at least leave the possibility open. So the question becomes, what's the sense in having a rule in which a district court just can't do anything about it? That it just, it's stuck.
Well,
the district court can simply defer issuing a judgment.
Of course, it can.
And is that,
and
does
manage.
That serve a purpose?
Is that what your answer is? I mean, that's the obvious thing
yes.
The district court can do is, look, there are some folks that you're looking for. I'll give you X amount of time, and then I'm going to issue. And you have Cambridge and a problem in time for appeal. I mean, that's the, as I understand your argument, that's the control you say that's either 54B or hold the judgment.
The court always has the ability to control the entry of the order. Yeah. So contingency here is different than Atias, and contingency here is governed by Cambridge and 54B. And Your Honor, that's the reason it's not an issue for purposes of this question. Also, there are some kind of aggravating facts in a sense here. The plaintiffs decided.
So if you had been plaintiff's counsel and you got this order, you would have said, "Oh, I've got to appeal right away.
I got to throw down, even if it's Rule 4A2, I've got to throw down a notice of appeal." Because I have nothing to lose. The structure of our rules say there is no problem with filing too early on a final order. There is a great liberal standard for plaintiffs. You only get a problem when you do not file in time, because that is jurisdictional. And that's what happened here. And, of course, there was the filing, I think, under Rule 54 that ultimately came 2 years later, in which, and it's on the docket, indicating that the plaintiffs were seeking a final order from Judge Lindbergh, but they then withdrew it. And we think that is further indication that there was tactical decisions that were going on and that were being considered with respect to the filing of the notice of appeal. So for all those reasons, we think Judge Lambert's order was a final one. and it was final, whether it's, as I said, 180 days or 30 days. I don't think that issue ultimately governs the result because the appeal is ultimately not noticed until, I think, 2016. Act of war. Does the court want to hear about act of war? I mean, just briefly, act of war is a very important matter, and it is not, as the plaintiffs say, the obverse of an act of terrorism. These two issues are completely separate. And that's indicated by the text with the separate presentation of act of war and what we say is a jurisdictional provision. And any other approach renders act of war a sort of a form of surplusage. And Judge Lambert did not make the mistake that you've seen sometimes some of the fractured jurisprudence that surrounds act of war. So act of war in this case requires an armed conflict and that the conduct be in the course of that conflict by military forces of any origin. There are also, as we've indicated...
How do you tell a military force from a terrorist group?
So it is a function of the context in which the hostilities are engaged, context, and it is a function, as Judge Lambert found, of capacity.
Well, do you agree with the premise of the question, which is that they're mutually exclusive?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. They're mutually exclusive?
Terrorist groups and military forces, are they...
Definitely not.
You think that there's overlap?
Definitely. No question.
In other words, how do you have a military force?
How do you tell an unaffiliated terrorist group from a loosely constituted terrorist group from a terrorist group that qualifies as a military force?
Their capacity at the time in question. In this case, it was easy to observe because they were engaged in battle, in essence, with an invading national military. So it isn't a situation which we keep saying, this is nowhere near a suicide bomber, you know, organized by a terrorist group that's sent into a civilian area. That's not what we're talking about. We're also not talking about, for example, the situation in Biden, which has some, I think, very useful illumination with respect to the operation of the act of war.
But you are talking about a designated foreign terrorist organization.
Yes, but that is not disqualifying, as Judge Lambert found, because the question is not a status. It is a question of what are they doing at the time of the tort in question. That's if they're wearing a military uniform on behalf of a foreign nation, it doesn't disqualify that particular combatant, for example, that he may otherwise have a U.S. designation. The question is his capacity in the context of the conflict. And there is no question that there was an armed conflict here. It was unlike most of the other cases that have come down. This was a situation in which there was a land invasion and mutual bombardment of each other's territory, a UN ceasefire that was ultimately generated that stopped the hostilities and that ended these exchanges of ordnance that you saw in this case. And with respect to the during the course of requirement, that, as we've indicated, we think is just a nexus requirement, whether, you know, for...
What makes someone a military force, or what makes a group, a terrorist group, a military force? What, you said capacity, that would seem to mean that they're all military forces. Presumably there's some group of isolated terrorists floating around who are not a military force, but maybe that's wrong. Maybe you think they're all military forces.
Well, we think in 4C, a military force of any origin incorporates this idea, and I think the case law supports it, that you can have things like paramilitary and militia, and you can even have armed citizenry, in fact. Mm-hmm. It depends, once again, are they rising, for example, to meet an invasion by a national force? If so, they are within the notion of a military force of any origin, at least for some period
reading
of time.
Reading it that broadly seems to take the teeth out of the statute.
I disagree, and the reason is that the act of war is intended to avoid these kinds of tort actions that arise out of foreign armed conflicts. And that's the reason it's so broad. If you compare, for example, other provisions that have kind of similar act of war kinds of provisions, they can be limited and have been limited to sometimes state militaries. But that's not true in our case. They've said we are not going to be litigating civil wars. We are not going to be litigating the question, for example, that the court raises as to whether or not there was sufficient organization.
Is Al-Qaeda, does Al-Qaeda count as a military force?
It depends on their capacity at the time.
So they could.
That's a yes. I mean, yeah. Of course they do under what you said.
Yeah. It would
100% under what you're under your test to Judge Trinivasan's question.
So imagine an invasion. Let's say Al-Qaeda is from Saudi Arabia. That, and there's an invasion by another country of Saudi Arabia, and those fighters are out defending Saudi Arabia and attacking the invasion. The answer is that that looks like active war. So for all these reasons, the district court should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, we'll give you some time on rebuttal to, you got a lot of different issues circling here.
I want to return very briefly to the Cambridge issue, but I'd like to move on because there are a lot of things to get to. We raised as an alternative argument in a reply brief the unique circumstances doctrine, which I think would be an alternative way to find this appeal timely. Namely, the appeal itself was timely. The 59E motion was untimely. And the 59E motion to alter or amend the judgment that was filed before the notice of appeal, that was untimely, in theory, if we accept that theory. And this court has held that under unique circumstances such as here, where we thought that we couldn't appeal reasonably.
Okay.
So.
Anything else on the timeliness point you want to make?
Let's move on.
Okay.
Yes. We were in the conversation with Judge Edwards, they were talking about the schedule, the order of events. I refer the court to pages 35 to 37 of our blue brief, and also to pages 40 and 41, where we speak out exactly what happened and how things worked out vis-a-vis the timeline. Holding here a copy of the district court's order. The area in brackets, this is 94-95 of the record. The area in brackets is the part of the order that resolved the case against the appellees. The rest of it involves subsequent proceedings. We're not talking about a line or two. The order was dominated by discussion of subsequent proceedings. The rule that the appellees are advocating would be extraordinarily unfair to people in my position. I know Judge Edwards thinks that the case law is clear, but respectfully, you know, to me it's not clear. And whether I'm right or not, the fact is, as a litigant in this position, how am I supposed to know whether or not I have to appeal?
Well, I mean, the simple answer to that is, which a good litigant, you would know, a protective appeal is very simple. And if you read Cambridge, it seems to me, if I'm in your position, I'm not taking any chances. I'm filing a protective appeal. End of discussion. So, I mean, you shouldn't ask that question, because if you need a good answer to that, you lose easily. Because it's a very simple way to do it, and parties do it.
Parties do it. It wastes the court's time.
Not if Cambridge says there's a possibility you're out of court. It seems to me you file the paper.
Okay.
But your broader point is Cambridge has some wiggle room.
A lot. And that's
dangerous in this context, you would say.
You want to have clarity.
Because you want to have clarity so litigants know what the heck to do.
Yes. Fine. Very briefly on Atias or Atias, however you pronounce it, the 2028J case, the decision is very clear that the intention of the district court, at least where the district court is saying this case is continuing, it's dispositive. And there might be a hypothetical case in an extreme situation where the district court was just off its rocker, but those aren't our facts. The district court clearly intended the case to continue. There was clearly plenty to litigate. We were doing it for the last 4 years. And, under Atias, that's dispositive. Owens, a recent decision of this court that I did not put a 28J in, I'm happy to, in raising. I didn't expect to bring it up. Owens tells very clearly with regard to the FSIA, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, that provisions in the same section but different subsections are analyzed separately for the purposes of determining the clear statement rule vis-a-vis jurisdiction. So Owens held that one subsection of the statute clearly talks about jurisdiction. Another subsection of the statute is unclear. That's that other subsection is the one the court was dealing with. Because they were in two different subsections, said this court, that's enough to make it not a clear statement. So my opponents are talking about, and I'll have you to file a 28J so my opponents can respond. I apologize, I'm doing it in this format. My opponents are talking about other statutory sections entirely. A subsequent section, which is not jurisdictional, but they say it is, indicates that this section also is jurisdictional. That's not true, A, and B, it's contrary to Owens, because again, Owens says you even look at subsections of a statute distinctly. Military force versus terrorist group. I see that I'm out of time. I'll just be very, very brief.
You can go for another minute or two.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. There was, by hypothesis, I'm not conceding anything here, but let's just say, by hypothesis, there was an armed conflict going on in Israel in Lebanon, between the Israeli military force and the Lebanese, and Hezbollah. Hezbollah fighters were separately launching rockets from presumably a different location. They weren't on the front lines doing this. They were doing it from some secure location, presumably beyond the front lines. So fighters who were not on the front lines, were not actively engaged in the Israeli military, launching rockets at civilians with no military objective at all. This is something that Hezbollah was doing before this conflict, something that they've done after this conflict and will probably, unfortunately, do again. This is their policy. They were doing it to kill civilians. That is not an act of war. That is an act of terrorism, quite clearly, and that is what Congress wanted to resolve in enacting the Anti-Terrorism Act.
Thank you. Since you'll be back. Okay. Thank you. The case is submitted.